Poverty, climate change, unemployment, name a problem, and Washington seems unable to solve it. Immigration, education, enter the mayor. Pragmatic, problem-solving, nonpartisan, mayors just might be the next best hope for democracy. That's according to political theorist Benjamin Barber. The title of his recent book puts it right on the line, If Mayors Ruled the World. Steve Paulson caught up with him at a Chicago conference on cities and sustainability.
Ben, why do you think we'd be better off if mayors ruled the world?
Well, we'd be better off if almost anybody else ruled the world than the people who are ruling it, which is the CEOs of giant carbon corporations and financial banks, which have no interest in public goods, which is the leaders of nation states stuck in ideology and embedded in their sovereignty and unable to cooperate. So you might say that almost anybody would be an alternative. I argue that mayors in particular, however, are efficient, pragmatic problem solvers, closer to their people, more democratic, and indeed, since cities today have over half of the world's population in them, in the Western world it's actually 80%, cities really are democratically representative of the world's population, and mayors are already cooperating with one another across borders and dozens of intercity organizations and global organizations. So in every way, mayors are better positioned, more capable of, and more interested in solving real human problems. It's all about real stuff. Real stuff. And if mayors don't do the real stuff, forget the rest. And it doesn't matter whether they're right or left, Republican or Democrat, Labor or Tory, mayors don't and can't afford to take sides. You can't as mayor say, I'm a union guy, don't talk to business, or I'm a business guy, don't talk to unions. You got to talk to both. You need a coalition. You need people to work with you. So mayors are problem solvers, they're pragmatists, and they're also neighbors. And what's interesting is that the trust level in politicians around the world at the national and state level is really poor. We know the Congress of the United States has dropped to an 8% trust rating. But if you ask people, do you trust your mayors, your city councilors, the trust levels are still at 70 and 75%, which is remarkable in these cynical times. So you might say urban democracy, municipal democracy, is the only place where people still really believe in democracy.
What about the big problems out there, whether it's crime or unemployment or a global problem like climate change? Is more effective action going to happen at the level of cities?
Well, again, cities are dealing with these issues for two reasons. One, because they have to, because the states aren't. And the second, because they can and they're well positioned to do so. Even an issue which most people associate with the national government, immigration. You know, the national government sets these standards for who can and who can't cross the border. But we know in the United States and Europe and all over the world, the great number of immigrants who cross borders cross illegally. They become undocumented residents of countries in which they have no right technically to be, but in which the logic of the global economy with jobs draws them. In the United States, we've got almost 12 million undocumented immigrants who are living here with families and so forth, and cities are in a position of saying, what are we going to do about them? The national government says they don't exist, and if they find them, they throw them out. And meanwhile, they live in great numbers. 10, 15% of urban populations made up of these immigrants. Mr. de Blasio of New York recently, in his State of the City, just announced he was going to make available city IDs, what some people call city visas, to every resident of New York who wants it. Doesn't matter whether they're documented, undocumented, immigrant, born New Yorker. You will get that ID. You'll be on the books. Your kids can go to school. You can get jobs. You can get medical care. The police will know who you are and what your address is so they can keep track of you and so forth.
So he's basically sidestepping the whole immigration debate in Congress.
He's saying, look, you guys aren't doing anything. You're frozen. You know, and you know there are 12 million people here who are, quote, illegal, but they're here and you're not telling us what to do with them. Well, we'll take the decision. We'll do it. My own belief is if enough cities do that, you'll find a soft road to full citizenship status, because a desperate government looking for a way to deal with the reality of undocumented workers will say, well, if they live for 5 or 10 years with a city visa in a city and live according to the law, maybe that's a good way to give them, put them on the road to national citizenship. But whether or not that happens doesn't matter. Immigration is an issue cities can and will deal with because they have to and because they can.
So when you look around the world, I mean, you know, you've studied cities around the world. I'm sure there are lots of cities that are doing things well, but two or three model cities that kind of jump out at you, well, this is how it should be done.
In Europe, Hamburg is an amazing city. It's just declared the first green capital of Europe. It does wind turbines in the city. It has zero emission buses. It has a program of compact communities in which you look for density and then put green spaces around them rather than the sort of massive spread that you have in so many American cities. So Hamburg is a place that's doing all these things, but it's doing it with a mayor who understands you can't do it at the expense of economic development. So he's working very hard to show that a sustainable economy and a prosperous economy are not incompatible, that you can do, if you find the right policies, you can do both at the same time. So Hamburg is a great example. Singapore, which is another city-state, well, some people have problems with a rather authoritarian government, although that's loosening up over time, has, in terms of housing policy and environmental policy, been a global leader. The housing system there allows people to buy subsidized housing and then resell it and keep the profits. And it allows people, when they're young, to have a one or two room. When they have families, the three or four room. When they get old, to stay in the same building and move to a one or two room. Again, the private development industry benefits because they build the housing. The population benefits because they're the ones to whom the housing is sold, and they own it, and they make the profits when it's sold. And everybody has a sense of place. Families stay together in the same building. It's been a very, very successful policy being imitated now in other cities around the world.
Well, let me ask you about Detroit. I mean, if there is a poster child of what not to do in a city, it would seem to be Detroit, which recently went bankrupt.
And totally wrong. I mean, that is to say, that perception, obviously it did go bankrupt. That's not wrong. Why it went bankrupt is because of the way in which we define our cities. Detroit and many other cities were, in the United States, founded in the 18th and 19th century. And of course, back then, the city limits were very narrow. Detroit, inside its old city limits, is one thing. That's a city that, in 1950, was the fourth largest city in the United States, with 2 million people, and all of the automobile industry located there. Very, very successful city. Within 40 years, it had lost two-thirds of its population. It's under 700,000 today. Half its schools, parks shut down. Terrible problem. And you say, so what, doesn't that show that, you know, Detroit and other old industrial cities can't make it? But here's the reality. The reality is the 10 counties around Detroit that make up the actual Detroit today, the greater Detroit metropolitan region, served by Detroit's cultural institutions, served by its universities, served by its transportation system. Those 10 counties, while Detroit was shrinking, went from 3 to 5 million people. A lot of the industry that left downtown Detroit settled in those counties around it. And those counties today are the fourth most advanced, prosperous, new tech zone in the United States. And if you count that as Detroit, Detroit's not bankrupt. It's one of the most successful areas of America, with a downtown area that has some problems that you got to deal with. But right now, the downtown area is in effect hived off, left with no resources, told to take care of itself, while all the counties that it created and whose prosperity came from Detroit in the city are off on their own, enjoying their resources, enjoying their tax revenues, but not taking responsibility. So a lot of places have that problem. They are narrowly defined by old jurisdictional boundaries, which no longer comport with the reality of how America's zones are drawn and the areas where people live and this and what they serve. New York City serves, with its transportation system, with its arts and culture, and with its financial industry, serves an area of about 30 or 40 million people. But it's reliant on the 8 million inside the five boroughs for its revenues, for its support, and so forth. And that's crazy. I mean, it's a really screwed up thing. And we really need a fundamental redefinition, a reboundarying of our cities. And to get that, you know, what you need is an urban party. You need citizens saying, wait a minute. So redrawing jurisdictional boundaries of cities is a big, big aim and objective for a smart mayors today.
Benjamin Barber is the author of If Mayors Ruled the World. Steve Paulson talked with him.